You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month we speak to two excellent Brighton-based debut novelists, Anya Card and Sarah Butler, both of whom have books out or forthcoming with excellent indie presses. Anya talks about writing not in her native tongue, about exploring queer identity, and how the writing community has helped her reach success. While Sarah talks about the move from short fiction to a novel and how the Sussex landscape has inspired her writing. We also speak to Rhiannon Lingwood from Brighton Fringe, who gives us an excellent preview of literature and spoken word events on at this year's iconic Fringe. The Brighton Book Club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. You can stay in touch with us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe and tell your book loving friends. Enjoy the show. It's after a night in Cardiff's loudest gay bar that Tony first lays eyes on Gav, a retired Welsh boxer, and his boyfriend Carol, an aspiring Polish photographer. The trio soon fall into an intimate, ambiguous love triangle. After a tragic event at a beach in Swansea, the trio are ripped apart and Tony escapes to London, becoming caught between a convenient, loveless relationship and an illicit, lustful affair. Lost halfway between the British future she had always wanted and the Eastern European past she had been running from, Tony can only wonder where and with whom she really belongs. Above Us the Sea is an ode to the tangled remains of lost loves and the imprints left by grieving souls yearning for connection. This is a story of aching and emerging, intimacy and distance set against an increasingly hostile landscape. Anya, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on Above the Sea finding a home.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So this is our Brighton debut episode, and I'd really like to know how you went from the initial idea to getting the publication deal.
It was a long journey for me because I never really set out to write a novel. And I really, at the very beginning, just wanted to see if I could write prose in English. I used to write a lot through my sort of teenage years and childhood. So I was just playing around with different ideas at first and different short stories that I was sort of putting together. But I think I've always sort of naturally gravitated towards a novel as a form. So it was sort of coming that way. And then as soon as I had my two main characters, Tony and Gav, I was really interested in exploring that relationship, the sort of romantic friendship, if you like, or non-romantic love. So that was sort of my starting point. And then I had Carol, and he sort of appeared in the story as Gav's boyfriend. And then I knew it would, I had like the center of the story, and it was about the three of them. But I never really had an outline, and I never really knew through my draft zero where I was going with the story. So I sort of panted my way through it, and it took about a year and a half of that first really rough draft, and then another year to sort of go over that, rewrite it, and have a story, like a full, still quite rough, but all the sort of chapters there and everything. And at that point, I moved out of London, moved to Brighton, got married. So there's a lot of things happening kind of personally in my life. And then at the end of that first sort of full draft, when the story was really there and the characters were there, I went to my first ever writing event up in Manchester, where I could pitch the idea to an agent. So that was my first experience of anything to do with publishing and writing groups, anything like that. And I remember the agent there was really encouraging, and she said to sort of get in touch, she liked the idea, when the novel was ready to just drop her a message. And so that was really, really encouraging, because at that point I hadn't shared it with anyone, I hadn't really spoken about the novel with anyone, or even really about writing, and I didn't know anyone else who was writing. And so I sort of then, I guess, took it more sort of seriously that there's something there and I can maybe do this, maybe I can, pull it off. And I started working with a mentor because I thought I was considering classes, and I decided to go with a mentor in the end because the story was in my mind then quite finished. Little did I know about all the editing to come. So I started working with a mentor through Jericho, actually, and I together with Donna, I think we did maybe two full rewrites together. So to me, that was like a 3 month intensive course in creative writing, and I learned so much from her, and the story benefited just so much from her advice and guidance. So that was about 3 4 months, and then I was sort of, I think, ready to query agents, and then again I found my agent quite early on through Jericho again, because I get quite sort of obsessive and nervous about these things, so I wanted to get everything just perfect and check every single thing. And so it was checking my, I think I, it was a query letter assessment, and that's how I met Claire, my agent, and we started working together. And actually, we didn't have much. She loved the story. She from the start, she was super supportive, and we only did minor edits together in the summer last year. And so maybe that was another, like a minor rewrite, I guess. And then we went out on submission in November, and I signed with Dead Ink in February this year. I think I covered it in the long term.
Dead Ink are a really exciting publisher. I really like their motto. They say our aim is to do whatever we want and to do it well. What appealed to you about working with them?
I think they DIY roots, first of all, because I sort of were not doing similar thing, but I was reconnected to DIY music scene in London for a few years. So that was sort of personally really important to me, and the commitment to just indie publishing. And as well, I think when I signed, it felt like a really exciting time to join them, as they got new investment. The bookshop had just opened. They're expanding the team, and yeah, it was really sort of just exciting to join them at the time, and the quality of writing. And I love that they sort of really want to publish what they want to publish, and they've done it so successfully over the years. So I was just really excited and proud to sort of be part of that. They rose there.
Can you read us an extract, please, from Above Us the Sea?
I can, yes. Just bear with me. This is also the first time I've ever, I'll ever, well, yeah, read it to anyone. So I haven't read it out to in any groups or anything. I just read it out to myself when I was editing. So yeah, hope I'll do it well enough. Okay. I first met Gav. Sorry, actually, let me rewind. This is the, I'm just going to read from the opening chapter.
Amazing.
So, just the first few paragraphs. I first met Gav 3 years ago on the dance floor of Pulse, Cardiff's loudest gay bar. Gav's face flickered in the whooping disco lights, and his body whirred in a dance to the sounds of Divine, a lithe body wrapped tight in a velvet red turtleneck and black leather trousers, unrestricted in a spectrum of motion, drawing men around him close. I admired the freedom in his movement, free from all of us dancing, free from our eyes on him, his face drowned in sound, eyes closed, lips mouthing the words with a smile as if he had never danced before, and the dance was the answer. It was all there was. I took a sip of my beer, dizzy with my new freedom clanging in my head, clumsy and heavy, so loud despite the music punching the air with beats. despite the eyes of women on me, despite the invitations, despite the sense of new territories palpable at the tip of my tongue, the particles of heat between bodies. It was all there was, freedom of everything finishing all at once. I glanced at a woman looking at me, afraid to make a move, to make a decision, struck in my stillness, keeping the future at bay, batting it away with another beer I took outside into the wet and mild Welsh winter. I looked at the swarms of men and women outside, groups guaranteeing safety. I moved to the edge of the beer garden, flanked by two circles of gossip and drama, running with passion and detail, funneling through my brain with images of people and places I didn't know. I took out the last cigarette I had haggled off a man on my way in and placed it between my lips, its taste always reliable. There he was again, and to my surprise, he was walking straight towards me with a confident stride, heeled leather boots clopping against the cobblestones. "You look lost," said Gav, a warm Welsh voice reverberating around me. There was something in the way he was looking at me, as if he needed to rescue something that night, and here I was, everything he'd been waiting for. He had the kind, affectionate eyes of a rescuer, a frown of attention above them lining his high forehead beneath short blonde spikes gelled upwards. "Is it that obvious?" I smiled and asked for a lighter. "Come here," he said, bringing his face close to mine and cupping my cigarette with the palm of one hand. Cool December air pushed in between my face and his neck, the flickering lights behind him highlighting the angles of his face, bony and pointed, blue eyes sunk deep in the cheekbones, eyelids covered in golden glitter, eyeliner climbing high above each eye. "There you go," the flame struck. I inhaled and blew the smoke away from his face. "You're a beautiful dancer," I said. "Oh, thank you, pet," thin lips spilled into a wide grin. "My God, I've missed it," he said and frowned in my direction. "Having a look around tonight?" I smiled. Was I having a look? I had never dared to look. "Maybe," I said, acting coy when everything in my body screamed in fear. "I'm Gav," he said, holding the cigarette by his face, head tilted to the side. "I'm Tony." "Are you a student here?" he asked, grabbing my hand and walking us away from the cackling voices, snaking into the quieter corner with a cha-cha step. "That's better now." "I was," I said, my voice louder, the statement definitive, pushing me forward. "I quit today." Gav's eyes widened at the revelation. "What are you going to do now?" "I don't know," I said, forcing a smile, hoping smoke concealed fear. I looked around, stamping the cigarette to the floor. I hated every minute of my degree. I had to break free, you know? Gav's face flashed with something else, eyes narrowed, inspecting me closely, in recognition, something in his face longing. "What is it like to be free then?" he asked. I looked down, teetering on my feet. "Right now," I said, "it's mostly scary." Gav squeezed my hand and looked away, smoke dispersing into the starry night, his grip strong, wiry hand enveloping mine. "Let's dance, darling," he said, pulling me gently towards the music. "Let's dance."
Oh, Anya, congratulations on your first live reading from the book. That
Thank
is
you.
Such a gorgeous opening. I was absolutely there. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm glad I managed to get through to the end without
You've done
any
it.
interruptions. Thank you.
You'll never have to do your first reading again. So migration is a theme in your writing and also in your life, because you are originally from Poland and now living in Brighton. How has this informed your writing?
I think it's been absolutely key. And I think in a way, I think I'll always be writing about migration. I think it's just a never-ending sort of daily exploration, and it's so many things and so many ideas. It's political, it's cultural, and I think to me it's always deeply steeped in language. And so I wanted to play with that. I wanted to play with the ideas of, you know, correct English, correct pronunciation, correct accent, and all the cultural and political baggage to do with that. So, and I guess obviously for me being from Poland, I wanted to explore the specifically Eastern European angle of that. And with so many, I guess, Polish immigrants living in the UK, I think there's about 1 million of us, if not more, I sort of felt there was the need of stories to tell our stories. So yes, so it's a huge, huge theme. I think it's the main theme for me. in all of my writing.
Did you ever consider, writing this book in Polish?
No, and to be honest, I don't know if I could. That's, I guess, one thing, because I've been sort of, well, I've been living with English in English for almost 15 years now, and for a long time, because, like I said, I used to write in Polish, write fiction. I felt really sort of between two languages, and sort of I'm so happy and relieved that I could find my voice in English and explore that and work with it, but also, yes, I think I wanted to again explore that sort of Polish English or immigrant English. So that was the sort of conscious decision to sort of capture that immigrant experience in England. And I couldn't do it in Polish. I had to do it in English. And how sort of it's sort of maybe to show that relationship between language and living in a foreign country. I think especially when you move somewhere at a young age, because Tony's 19 when we meet her, she's pretty much just left high school. She comes to Cardiff for university, like I did. So you're sort of growing up with that language, and I wanted to with a new language, second language, and I wanted to explore that relationship.
Is it important to you, Anya, to portray a side of Eastern Europe that people n might not have read before, for instance, exploring queer identities?
Yes, definitely. So there was, I guess there's two parts to it, because I think part of me for a long time was quite angry at really sort of like reductive representation of the Eastern Europeans in culture, in film or TV that I've just come across, sort of one-dimensional with always with broken English, etc. And that didn't really reflect my experience and the experience of my friends. So I guess I was confronted with a choice of I can just be angry about it, or I can just actually tell the story and sort of own that narrative, own that voice, and contribute something for myself. And in terms of queer identity, it's something that's personal for me. That's just, my community, my experience, but also politically. I think it was important to me to have Polish queer characters at the really the forefront of the. Of a very British story, it's set in Britain, because of the political situation in Poland. And then when I was at the time when I was writing it, we still had Poland still had very homophobic government, still no legislation for Poland still hadn't got a civil partnership, not to mention same-sex marriage, and some like really hostile sort of events were taking place, like LGBTQ free zones that people were sort of free to set up in the local villages and towns, etc. Some horrific stuff. So I really wanted to, I guess, be political in that sense with my characters, and maybe bring attention to that, as like Poland still one of the very few countries, I think, left in Europe, which is still quite homophobic on a legislative level.
Absolutely. What's the reaction been from early readers? Because the book is not out until July, and we're going to talk a bit about pre-orders in a moment. But it must be amazing to know that there are little pockets of people around the world just slowly, slowly being introduced to your writing.
Yes, it's been actually completely surreal to have people read it, because initially it was just like my closest friends, like my who were my first beta readers and like or editor, agent, etc. So it's sort of out there, and I've had first reactions and really, really positive and lovely messages. So it's just yeah, it's just been amazing to get, because I think as writers we just create an isolation and hope, but we sort of I think we all create that validation of what I love this story and I believe in it, but what if it's just not good? What if it doesn't sort of get the reception? I think everyone sort of we all sort of have it at the back of our heads. So to kind of be to have this positive response has been absolutely amazing, and just Yeah, it's just great to get that validation and encouragement to keep writing, and yeah, to keep writing and to new stories, I guess.
So, Anya, you are a writer in Brighton. Can you talk a bit about the community here and does the city inspire any of your writing?
So to answer that second question, it has, and I'm writing my second novel now, and it's set in Brighton, so it absolutely has inspired me, and I love living here, and it was one of the best decisions ever to move here, and it's been amazing actually to find a community of writers as well, and so quickly. So because when we moved, I didn't really know anyone, so it was really building from scratch, even like sort of friendship groups, etc. So to have that and the writing community, West Hill Writers, Real Writers Circle, and sort of and slowly just making friends within those groups. And I feel like I've had this, I've always I've felt really supported in the last year, and had people around me that really believed in me and supported me. And it was just been really great to have to be able to meet in person and talk about writing with other writers, because online communities are amazing, and you know, like social media is also really great for that. But I think it's been extra special to have that in Brighton too.
So, Anya, the book is out in July, and I know how important pre-orders are, especially for small press publishers. How can people support you and this book?
Pre-orders are, yeah, super, super important, like you're saying. And I think especially for indie publishers and indie authors, where there's no big money sort of behind marketing of the book. So I'm so grateful to everyone who's already pre-ordered and everyone who can pre-order, because it's a huge, huge help and it's putting the book out there. So if you can, thank you so much. If the book sounds interesting to you and you can pre-order, I'm so, so grateful. And yes, that's the main thing we can anyone can do now. And I guess if you want to follow me as well on social media, I'll be shouting about the book more and more as we're sort of getting closer to the launch date and publishing date.
Thank you so much for joining us, Anya. Above Us the Sea is out in July with Dead Ink Books. Starling can trap a rabbit, cook a meal from a hedge, and hear a bailiff coming from a mile off. All she has ever known is a nomadic existence, travelling in a converted van with Ma, her strong-willed mother. But Ma has cut them off from their community, and this winter they're stuck in deep mud in a wood with no fuel, no money, and no friends. One morning, without explanation, Ma leaves and doesn't come back. Utterly alone, Starling must learn to survive without her mother and build a life on her own terms. An offer to stay with an old friend draws her into a more conventional way of living. But can rootless Starling ever find a place where she truly belongs? Sarah, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on the publication of your debut novel, Starling.
Thank you, Anna. I'm really, really happy to be here.
So, where did the inspiration for this book come from?
It is a really long time ago that I started writing Starling, but so some of the origins are a little bit vague, but what I do remember is that I had a very strong visual image of a young woman walking away from me across an empty landscape. And she was definitely escaping something, but also trying to get to something else. And I didn't know what it was, but that was my character. That was Starling. And I just had a feeling for the kind of person she was. So I quite often start with a character and a location. And that was kind of where it was. But there was also a feeling of a separate thing which came together of what would it be like to be the child of an incredibly domineering, strong-willed, determined parent who lives according to their beliefs entirely. So where's the space for the child in that? And what happens when you grow up? And I'm not the daughter of a parent like that, and I don't think I'm a parent like that myself, but I've observed it, and I just thought, what would it be like to say to be stuck in a room where you can't escape from your mother who just dictates terms the whole time? And you know they're right, but there isn't much room for you.
So I guess you had to do quite a lot of kind of psychological research then.
I think I just watch the world around me and guess and imagine. So it takes quite a while to find the characters in all their depth, but it's really telling that right at the beginning when I started writing it, I drew some sketches of characters in charcoal. And I'm not an artist by any stretch, and I don't draw all the time, but sometimes I find it useful to just do really loose sketches. And there's a little tiny charcoal sketch from all that time ago of a strong figure with a very small bouncy figure next to it, and that's Ma and Starling. And I didn't need to do that much more than that. I mean, all of us have lots of things inside us. I could be an incredibly domineering person. My children might say I'm quite bossy and opinionated. And so it's if you let go of all of that and you pursue it, you just kind of follow the bits that are inside you and see where you could take them, I think.
So this is our Brighton debut episode, and I'd really like to know how you went from initial idea to getting that publication deal. What has your journey been? Because if you don't mind me saying, you've written your debut and it's published, when you're over 50.
Yeah. I was 59 when it was published, or 58 and a lot, I think. Yes, it has been a really long road, and I think it's really common. I finished university and I got a job, and then I got other jobs, and I had a house and I had children, and I had to work hard to pay bills, and I did not have time to write anything big. I didn't really have headspace more than anything else. I started writing, I guess, in my 30s. Did a writing course, which was just a revelation. I realized I could write, but then I had two babies and I was working full time. So I didn't really have time to do anything, but I kind of kept dipping in and out. And finally, when I thought I had time to write a book, I didn't really have time to write a book. In 2013, I had a kind of really loose bundle of ideas, including that vision of a young woman walking away from me. And I went away on a week-long solitary writing retreat in Cornwall, to a house right on the edge of the sea. And I had no idea what I was doing. Absolutely no. I just thought, sat there thinking, I don't know what to do. I'll go for a walk. I'll do some sketches. I'll make lots of notes. But I didn't know what I was doing at all. So it took me quite a long time to make any kind of sense of my ideas for my characters and the kind of general vague feelings of plot. But eventually, I kind of began to make a shape of it. And then I did another course that I did online, a 3 month how to write your novel course with the Unthanks organization and a great teacher called Stephen Carver, which just said, okay, write an opening chapter, share it with us. And it made you do it. And then write the next bit. And here's how you might shape the story arc. And so I think it took me about three more, four years to actually write the novel. And I had gaps because my children were still about. I had various people who needed my help. My health was not good. I have ME, so I have to pace myself, and sometimes I kind of collapse and get ill. So it took me nearly 10 years to write it. And then I finished the script, the first really full version in March 2020, which, we all know, difficult time. And then I kind of tweaked it and I sent it out, but I knew it wasn't going to go because I'd actually set the first full version of Starling. Starling walks out of the van into a viral pandemic, which isn't what happens in the actual book because I realized that it was too realistic. Everything that happened was entirely predictable. And I had predicted it. I had done a lot of research. And nobody wanted to read a book about a young woman walking into a town where everyone's getting ill with a viral pandemic because that just wasn't going to be fun. And I did not enjoy it. So I put my book on the top shelf and thought, right, I'll come back to it in a couple of years, strip out that element of the plot because I loved my character. I loved the setting. I loved the challenge she faced, which was overall being abandoned, feeling abandoned, and not knowing where she fitted. And I had sent it to some agents who all wisely said no, and I sent it to Fairlight, the publisher, and they came back to me and said, would you like to change your script and take out that element, the pandemic element? Because if you would, we really love your characters and your writing. So that's what I did. I sat
Love
down and
that
spent
story.
6 months rewriting. Yeah.
We're going to move on to Fairlight in a bit, but before that, can you please read us an extract?
Absolutely. I'm going to read right from the beginning, so no spoilers. So this is chapter one. Spring had come too early, and frost had blackened the first buds. Under the soil, the seeds and roots waited again, and Starling waited too. Everything to its time, Mar always said. Mar would leave when it was time to leave. At least the van was warm inside. It smelled of wood smoke, damp wool drying, onion soup. Dawn was a way off, and Mar was still asleep. Starling could hear her breathing slow and steady below the pebble dash rattle of the rain on the roof. It had rained ever since they'd arrived, a winter of rain, and the van wouldn't make it out of the wood, even if Ma said it was time. The mud at the start of the track had been axle deep when they drove in, the puddles glittering in the Lutons' headlamps as they closed the gate behind them, twisting the blue nylon rope back over the post. They were miles from the nearest house, and safe for a while, she hoped. Fate smiles upon us, Ma had said, and the bare dark trees had swallowed them up. Starling slept on her left side, eyes part open, the mattress shaped to her hip just below the narrow shelf that ran high along the van's sidewall. She fitted into small spaces. Along her shelf lay a line of pale shells, a hagstone ready to hang, a jay's turquoise feather. Everything that mattered was in the small bag under her head. She didn't need to look to see Ma. She would be lying on her back, eyes closed, breathing evenly as a midsummer sea swell. Ma released her hair at night and it spread deep red across the pillow, hung in great hanks over the side, touching the floor. Unlike Starling, nothing about Ma was small. She filled every space. Not that she was a giant, she stood a couple of fingers taller than most and she carried no fat. But when she came into a room or stepped into a fire circle, people moved back. Only Starling fitted beside her. Starling sensed a vibration out beyond the clearing. She opened her eyes wide in the faint light. She opened her eyes wide in the faint light filtered by the curtains. Nothing. It was a nothing. She let out her breath slowly and sat up, pushed her hair out of her eyes and slid down to the floor. She let Ma sleep on. It was probably a fox. She lifted the door so it wouldn't creak as she opened it and stepped out, sniffed. Yes, a fox. She pulled her boots on and squelched across into the wood to pee, remembered she'd need to dig a new pit soon. Back in the van, she lifted the kettle. No water. Ma had been up late the night before and must have made tea to keep herself warm. Starling had lain in bed, listening to her rocking in her chair by the burner. At about midnight, the rain had stopped briefly, and she'd heard Ma open the door and stand in silence, listening to the night noises outside. An owl's cry, a badger's claws clattering over a log, a fox's scream, the whisper of a dark wood. Starling had turned over and slept. She took the water container and headed out, long-tailed tits lifting out of the bare branches ahead of her like a crowd of excited children on a windy day. The high sky held a handful of light. This wind might blow in new weather, carry away the late rain at last, but she didn't think so. She stamped through the wood, swinging the container, watching a patch of blue sky grow and vanish over the hill. She chewed on a pinch of early blackthorn flowers, enjoying their bitter crispness, and started to hum. When she reached the field gate on the edge of the wood, she climbed over and left the container tucked in by the fence. Here, where the wood reached into the field, a small sheltered patch of grass held the sun, and the first nettles had pushed up through the damp soil a week ago. Now they were knee-high, leaves unfurled, startling green against the earth. Starling pulled a bag from her pocket and cut a cloudburst of nettle tops into it. Slim pickings, but she could smell the green in them, the spinachy tang they'd give the day's soup. As she came back through the trees, she saw fresh smoke coming from the chimney. Ma must be up. She must have found something to get the burner going. A curl of white fell through the air. Starling caught it and another, held them on her palm, two scorched fragments of printed paper falling like seeds, sewing letters on the wood's floor. She went in. Ma was folding up her bedding, completely engaged with the task. Every task matters equally, she would say. Starling placed the kettle on the burner, bent and opened its door. Paper spilled out, not quite burned through, the print blackened by the heat. As the air reached the scorched edge of her book, the words turned to flame and twisted up through the smoke into the flue, forcing Starling to pull her hand away. There you go.
Thank you so much. Your sense of character and place are absolutely beautiful. And I'd really like to ask you about your relationship to the Sussex countryside and how that inspired or informed your writing of Starling.
I mean, I guess it's mostly I'm very local. I grew up in and around Tunbridge Wells, went to school there, and have lived in this area, apart from when I went to university and lived abroad as part of that. I've lived in this area absolutely all of my life. And I've lived in the village I live in now for coming up for 30 years. So I know it really, really well. I think there's one thing that I used to be a very rushing around kind of person when I was younger, but then I got unwell with ME and that made me really slow down. So I walk very slowly a lot of the time. And I pay very close attention. It's one of the ways that I can spin out a walk for quite a long time, but not go very far and really enjoy it. So I will stop and look in a ditch and poke a hedge. And I will be that woman lying in the grass, peering at a small insect on a leaf and wondering what it is. I don't have deep knowledge of nature, but I'm learning all the time. So I kind of... I guess I just relate to the landscape because I'm in it a lot, as much as I possibly can be. And I'm engaged in, you know, wildlife stuff as well. So I run a small wildlife group in my village, and I'm just about to do a project trying to do citizen science on the river. So I'm quite a lot of the time talking about and thinking about the nature of Sussex. And it's really, really important to me. So Starling isn't necessarily set in Sussex. It's not, nowhere is ever named, that the place names are all made up in it, but it's been very interesting meeting readers. They quite often go, oh, it's set here, isn't it? And I'm going, maybe. It's set in a place that feels very familiar to me. It's a high-willed kind of landscape, but it isn't ever named.
So I know that before you wrote Starling that you've written short stories for years, so I'd love to know why a novel, why this one, and why now?
I think I started out writing short stories because that's the obvious place to start if you don't have much time and you don't really know what you're doing, which is ridiculous because short stories are very hard to write and wonderful things. And I think I would probably have carried on, but I was finding myself writing ever more complex short stories. And looking back, I realised that I probably was starting to write novels because I kept introducing more characters and more plot lines and they don't fit in a short story at all. So there was just an urge to tell something more complex, and it wasn't necessarily Starling, but Starling just kind of emerged. I don't know really why I wrote this book rather than any other book. I always have lots of ideas, but this is the one that just kind of came out of me and held my interest, I guess. I knew that this was something I wanted to tell over time. I wrote a book I wanted to read. I think that's really important. If you write a book that you just think other people might want to read, you're not going to put your heart in it. And I love to read books with really strong characters and strong locations. You know, I'm thinking of books like Sarah Hall's The Wolf Border and Hannah Kent's Burial Rites, where you've got amazing characters who are not necessarily easy. They're complex characters. You don't go, oh, yeah, they're obviously the person that I'm going to back. You ask questions of them, but they also have a really sort of strong sense of location. And there's often a sense of movement. And I wanted a real strong sense of movement as well. I didn't want to write a static book where people just sit in a room talking. I wanted them to get out there and do stuff. And I was thinking about it. And I think as a child, I loved books about how you survive in the wild. You know, books that were factual books and books that were non-factual books. I learned how to track and all sorts of things. And I think I still do. I think I find that fascinating. What do you do when you're stripped right back to just you and what's around you? You know, you can't just use your credit card or go in a shop. You have to live off your own means and skills. And I think I I like writing about things that frighten me. I think that's interesting, exploring your own fears. So I wanted to think about losing your home and losing all the people that you loved around you and being totally alone, because that's something that I don't have in my life. And I think I'm quite resilient. I did live in France for a year when I was much, much younger, when I was a student, and I didn't know anybody at all. And actually, I found I could do it. I was really happy. I made new friends, but it was important that I made friends when I was there. I'm not someone who lives in isolation. So I wanted to kind of find out what that would be like. And I found myself wanting to write about the importance of love and friendship, which I didn't really expect. But that was an underlying theme as I wrote Starling, and it wasn't there in the very early versions. Didn't really know what I was doing then, and that kind of came through as the thing that's pulling Starling on all the time, I think.
So, what books and authors inspire you, Sarah? This is kind of giving me like a bit of Emma Donoghue's Room, a bit of kind of Claire Fuller's Unsettled Ground. What writers and books have inspired the writing of Starling?
Yeah, I mean, I love both of those. Claire Fuller, I came to only quite recently, and I don't know quite how I managed to miss her writing before, because it's their endless number of days, isn't it? I think that she wrote where there's a that you don't really know what's going on, mother, a father and child. And the father's a kind of survivalist, and you're thinking, ooh, that's really weird. And then there's obviously something going on, and he takes her to a really remote mountain, in the Austrian Alps, I think, somewhere in the mountains anyway, in Europe. And you think, wow, what a setup. That's just fabulous. Because who would have thought it? She writes kind of on a domestic level with people in a small space who are related and getting on in difficult ways, but with epic sweep. And you go, oh yes, I love that. I love that courage. I don't think I'm much like Emma Donoghue's Room, but I did love that. I wouldn't be able to write it. I think I would just found that too claustrophobic as a writer to be in that space as well. I needed space to breathe, I think. I love Sarah Moss. I think she's a really beautiful writer and very varied too. I came to her through I can't remember the title. It's got bodies in it, and it's 19th century, set in the 19th century, with a family of daughters who are kind of trying to break out of the constraints of their society. And it's beautifully, beautifully observed, beautiful characterization. And then, now she's writing quite a lot of stuff about which are kind of related to climate and climate breakdown. Like there's a story recently where everyone's out and they're on holiday and it's just lashing with rain the whole time. It's an utterly grim. There's a catastrophe. Quite bleak. I like the fact she's not afraid of bleak. I really like bleak. Trying to think what else I love. So I realized I wrote a piece recently about solitude, and I realized I really like books where a character is dropped on their own somewhere. So there's Christiana Ritter. This is non-fiction. Beginning of the 20th century, went to the polar Arctic with her husband and another man just for a whole year. Really, really remote. She thought she'd have a nice retreat. She was an artist. Really wasn't that nice. It was very cold, very grim, very tough. But as the year unfolds, she discovers the beauty of that place. There's lots not said. She has a child or children, and she's left them behind. She never mentions them. It's like, okay. So I'm just interested in quite extreme situations and what people do. But I also love the small domestic. I very happily read something where basically someone just sits there and doesn't really do anything. I'm just not going to write it.
One of my favorite non-fiction books in that ilk is Amy Liptrop's The Outrun. I love that book, set in the kind of the really remote Scottish Highlands. And it's dealing, like you say, about the kind of Claire Fuller books. The scope of it is huge, and it's talking about life and addiction and, mistakes and redemption, but it's really set in complete isolation in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and you can find isolation in different ways. So I don't know if you've read Nancy Campbell's Thunderstone. I think that came out this year, maybe last year. She's a poet, and I haven't, I confess, read other books by her yet, but they are definitely on my list. And she, this is a story, it's true, so it's a memoir, and I think it's during the pandemic, is it? She has a long-term relationship that is breaking down, but her partner is catastrophically ill, so she has to look after her, even though the
Wow.
relationship is not working at all. And then there's a moment where she just says, I can't do this anymore. And she goes and lives in a caravan in a kind of swampy, woody spot on the edge of the Thames. And it's real edge land. There's a whole bunch of other people living there with whom she begins to interact. But basically, she's on her own in her caravan, dealing with the complete throwing up in the air of the life that she did have. I think she's a woman who likes to take risks. She's quite an intrepid traveller. But it is basically her and her caravan dealing with all sorts of things that don't work. And she gets ill herself and so on. So it's quite small in scope. It's maybe a year of time in a really small and unexciting space, but it's beautifully written and incredibly open-eyed and honest. I definitely recommend it.
So, Sarah, you're published by Fairlight Books, another indie publisher. What has your experience been of working with a small, innovative press?
I think it was completely joyful, actually. I mean, A, thank you, Fairlight, for publishing me. It's really, really hard to get published, and I feel very honoured that they chose my book. I mean, they specialise in literary publishing. It's not kind of scary literature where you have no idea what on earth the writer's doing. It's quite accessible literature, but it's really good quality. And I did spend quite a long time researching publishers, thinking I want one that takes real care over the production values of the books and things like that, because you do sometimes see some pretty shonky covers and things. And I have a background in publishing. So long ago, I worked in book publishing in non-fiction reference. So I kind of understand how the process works. So they were lovely. They publish, I think, maybe about five or six full-length novels a year and novellas, which are great. It's really unusual that people publish novellas. Great commitment there. I had a really fabulous editor called Laura Shanahan, who's now moved on. She's gone freelance. So if anyone out there needs an editor, find Laura Shanahan. She's just great. Really clear thinking, very gentle in the way she phrases things, but she spots the key issues with your work and kind of goes, I wonder whether, and you go, oh, thank you so much, Laura. But she didn't make lots of changes. She said she was the one who suggested chopping out all of the pandemic element. And just I said, well, how about I do it like this? And she said, yeah, that sounds good. And so I just went and did it. And she made two small but significant changes to the final script. And that was basically it. The cover, I had a suggestion, and they very wisely went, maybe we won't use that person. But they took the idea of the van in the wood, which is what's on the front cover, and came up with a piece of artwork. And I made a suggestion to change it slightly to do with the color of the sky. And they went, yeah, sure. And the cover, I think, has been one of the best things. So going into bookshops, bookshop owners have absolutely loved that cover, and it's face out in lots of places. I mean, it's face out in my local Waterstones. And that's possibly because they love Starling. I think it may be partly they like Starling, but it's also because it's a really good cover. It's kind of juicy. It makes you go, ooh, what's going on there? And it's different. It's not got, I said, please, no young woman looking away into the distance. There's a lot of those.
It must feel great to have this book out in the world. What's the reaction been from readers?
It's been just joyous for me because people are really generous. You'll get, there's a one star review out there with someone going, this writer's tried too hard to be poetic. And you think, well, don't read it then. But generally speaking, people just come up to me, and it's been a little while that it's out now, and people come up to me or they send me messages, and some of them I know and some of them I don't, and they just say how much they've loved it. And they love it for different reasons. I think we all bring our own selves to every book we read. But they love the characters. They're often quite conflicted about Ma, because Ma is a tricky character, which is why she's interesting. There are people who really hate Ma. There are people who love Ma, and they want to know what happens next. People say, are you going to write the sequel? I mean, no, definitely not. That's it. I had a whole bunch of early readers come back and say, how they loved being taken into a whole different world and imagining a different way of living. Because Starling does live an incredibly alternative way of life, and she's grown up on the road with people who would have been called New Age travellers, and most of us have not experienced that. One of my big anxieties was I haven't experienced that, and so I did a lot of research. But I was really concerned that maybe I had misrepresented that world. But I had one early reader who lived on the road who read the whole script early on for me, and he made one change to when a plant came into season and one factual change about who would repossess a van. And that was it.
Wow.
And then other people came in after the book was published, and they had lived or were living on the road, and they just said, this fit rings completely true. And I was just so happy about that, really happy about that.
Yes, that must have been a relief and testament to your impeccable research, I'm sure. So, Sarah, you're a writer in Sussex. Can you tell me a bit about the writing community here?
I mean, it's weird. I guess we all have our own strange shaped communities. So I am in Sussex, but I'm in quite rural Sussex. So I'm not in a city like Brighton. So I'm not part of the Brighton writing community, because Brighton's about an hour away from me. And I guess I've just gradually met people over the years. I meet more people now I'm published. That's been interesting, that people notice you and they reach out. So I've met, say, an artist, not a writer, who just got in touch and said, "Oh, I saw you doing a talk about rivers and writing about rivers, and I'm painting rivers. Shall we get together?" And we're doing some work together. In terms of, I think if you live in rural Sussex, one of the best things is the independent bookshops. They are incredible. I mean, Kemp Town Bookshop in Brighton were really early supporters. They put on an event right at the beginning, when Starling came out in hardback. But I have to give a massive call out to the East Grinstead Bookshop and Barnett's in Wadhurst. They are amazing, amazing independents who really back local authors. So they've both put on events for me. And I've taught workshops with both of them. I've been in there. You can practically hear them going, "You should read this book, The Starling. It's really excellent." And they are wonderful if you're a reader or a writer, because you go in and they are passionate about books. They know so much about the books, and they will, if I go into either of them, they say, "Have you read this yet, Sarah? It's amazing." And they'll introduce you to other writers, which is so teaching the workshop. I had a guy called Jim Hindle came along to one of my workshops, which is on nature writing, and he's just sent me a message saying he's doing a reading and he's a wonderful writer at the Hop Yard tonight. This is December. He's doing a reading there, and he's going to do another event in the bookshop in East Grinstead next year. And so you gradually begin to find the people who are in your world and understand your kind of writing and your way of thinking. Some of it's luck. I've got a lovely friend, Gemma Borg, who lives near me. She's a poet. Her book Wilder was up for the T.S. Eliot finals last year. She's a beautiful, stunning writer, and I feel really lucky to have come across her. And then there's the Kent and Sussex Poetry Society, which does lots and lots of events and regular readings from really great writers. I'm not a poet. I do write poetry, but I don't think of myself as a poet. But through them, I'm a, kind of gradually build your community. And it's just a complete joy after many years of not really knowing any writers to just beginning to have a whole bunch of people that I can just have coffee with and talk about the stuff of writing.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Sarah. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of Starling?
Well, you can get hold of Starling in any good bookshop, because it's, published widely. I think most of the local bookshops should have copies, and if they don't, they'll get them for you really quickly. You can find me on my website, which is www.sarahjanebutlerauthor.co.uk, and there you'll find all of my socials as well, so you can link to me from that.
Thank you very much for joining us. Starling is out now with Fairlight Books. Brighton Fringe is back in 2024 and promises to be bigger and better than ever. And I am joined by Rhiannon Lingwood from the Brighton Fringe to tell us everything we need to know about this year's event and give us a heads up about literature and spoken word events that we should be going to. Rhiannon, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we need to know?
What do you need to know about Brighton Fringe 2024? Well, this year we're asking audiences to find your fringe. We know that the Brighton Fringe programme can be overwhelming at times. Last year, we had 880 events across 126 venues. We're hoping to have a similar number of events. We've asked shows and events to categorise themselves as whether they are funny, weird, talented, whether they contain a story, whether they are thrilling, or whether they help you get in your groove. So you will see this across our social media, advertising our shows in these categories. And you can also search with these terms on our website. The idea behind this is often people don't know what necessarily what genre they want to go and see. They don't know where what venue they want to go to. They don't know what venues are taking part. So this was a way of us helping you find your fringe through a feeling rather than sort of knowing what venue and what genre you wanted to go and see. So if you're in the mood for something weird, the search on our website will spit up shows from comedy, theatre, spoken word, all of the different genres. So you'll get a selection of genres, a selection of venues across the city under that category. But we have got some storytelling shows this year that I wanted to tell you about. So the first one is called Tales in the Key of Terror. It's on at St Mary's Church on the 3rd of May, and then again on the 1st of June at the Brighton Toy and Model Museum. It's sort of a spooky storytelling performance with immersive soundscapes and projected images. The stories are horror stories that are brought vividly to life, and they're ghost stories. One is about a gambler in the Old West, and the second story is a sci-fi horror. And I think in particular, these would be great to see in Brighton Toy and Model Museum. If you've never been in there, it's definitely worth a look. And I think a horror story in that venue is going to be really exciting to see and enjoy. The other spoken word show that I wanted to talk about is The Encrypted Forest, which is taking place at a variety of Laughing Horse venues during Brighton Fringe, including The Quadrant. That will run from the 28th to the 31st of May. And this show will combine elements of storytelling, audio drama, sound art, lecture performances, and lo-fi hip-hop instrumentals. Audience members will enter a realm where the mystical and the digital merge to form a collective haunting of our lost futures. I thought the bringing together of tech and the arts was really interesting, and I thought that would be really exciting. Final show I wanted to tell you about is Character Floor, which is a storytelling show about queer identity and neurodiversity. This show actually won the Brighton Fringe Award for Excellence at Edinburgh Fringe and is now being brought to Brighton by the Actors Theatre. So it'll be hosted there from the 9th to the 12th of May. This is a really, really wonderful show, really heartwarming and definitely worth seeing. There are a lot of shows about at the moment concerning topics of queer identity and neurodiversity. And this one was really special and really gentle and a really lovely examining of Pip's experiences with those topics.
Thank you so much. I feel like we've had a really great preview, and it's really nice to have a bit of curation with events because, like you said, there is just so much going on. The Fringe is my favourite month in Brighton. I cannot wait.
Yeah, we're really excited. We've got some new venues as well as part of Brighton Fringe this year. So Laughing Horse, who do a lot of comedy programme, and they look after the Carolina Brunswick and the Walrus. They're also introducing a new venue at the Windmill, the pub upstairs on Upper North Street. So that's really exciting. The team at Latest are taking over Horatio's Bar on the Pier with a few plays there. So that's a really great venue to have back in the Fringe. The Ironworks are opening up a second venue, so a second space in their venue in collaboration with Roger Kay, who used to run the Rialto Theatre. And that will be a black box theatre showing lots of traditional theatre and cabaret. And also Head First Acrobats, who have been at Brighton Fringe the past several years with really popular circus shows such as Gods and Railed and their popular kids shows, Pre-Hysterical. They'll be bringing their own venue to Brighton Fringe for the first time, just south of St Peter's Church, hoping to host lots and lots of circus and acrobatics, as well as theatre and cabaret and comedy. So yeah, we've got lots of really exciting stuff going on.
Thank you so much for joining us. You can check out everything and grab tickets on the Brighton Fringe website. Thank you for listening. We will be back next month with a jam-packed episode featuring Graham Bartlett, Katie Massey, and Tanya Byrne.